So, welcome everybody. This is the fifth lecture in my course on purification, ethics, and karma in early Buddhist discourse. First, again, we have a look at the blog and review, and after that, we will get into purification and the parallel to the Ratavinita Sutta. Yeah, the blog is getting very lively. I really appreciate that there's quite a lot of discussion also among the participants there. There's a topic that came up quite a lot and with very interesting comments was on the practice of loving kindness. I am not going to comment on that now. The practice of metta is a major topic to be covered in this course when we come to Madhyamagama 27. That is the parallel to the Dhananjani Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. Probably not this year, but next year's course. And at that time, I thought of going in quite detail on loving kindness and in particular how it is practiced or how I think it is practiced according to the canonical instructions. There was one comment on the Metta Sutta on the blog. Somebody has quoted someone else who classified the Metta Sutta as late. And I thought I take this up first for some a little bit methodological reflections. Originally, when I started this series, I thought that the first lecture I have to give very detailed exposition of what is oral transmission, what is the methodology, and everything. But then I thought it's better to just work with the discourses, and when things come up, then we have a look at them. In that way, it becomes more practical and easier to understand and to follow the point that I'm trying to make, I think. And last time we discussed a little bit, or I presented my viewpoint on this issue of a discourse not having a parallel and this fluidity of the transmission. And I think all of us, by having read now eight discourses against their Pali parallels, we get some feeling of what it means to have a different line of transmission that we can access and see what are the differences, but also what are the similarities. And what I personally find so fascinating of comparative studies and what makes me spend quite a lot of my time with it is that I think this is really a very sound methodological approach for coming to a conclusion what is early Buddhism and what is a little bit later. And this stands quite in contrast to what during very early generations of Buddhist studies were used as the basis for deciding if something is late or not. Because there, I hope I'm not being too strong on early Buddhist scholars, the early generation of early Buddhist scholars, but there it seems to me the main criteria was entirely subjective. Something that is not really fully understandable or not fully clear, and then it must be late. If we look at the history of Buddhist studies, especially the early generations, we get all kinds of theories. I mean, there is Caroline Rice Davies, really an outstanding scholar and an outstanding woman for her time. But with all the respect I have for her, she was totally convinced that this thing about not self is just impossible. The Buddha taught something like that. That is just, the Buddha was such an extraordinary person. How could he not realize that there's a self? So anywhere where we get anything on anatta in the discourses, she was very sure that this is just later generations. They added this. And I think it's her or I.B. Horner that also suggested that the five aggregates, this is not part of early Buddhist teaching. And then the four stages of awakening, because they are not mentioned among the fours of the Anguttara, it must also be late. And some other scholars have found in quotation marks, have found out that the jhanas, this possibly, no, this cannot be early Buddhist teachings or the immaterial attainments. And I think I can continue like this a little further. I think the principle of dependent arising, Paticca-samuppada, was also identified as not being early Buddhist teaching. If I continue a little further, there's pretty much nothing left. All of these theories have not been very successful. I think nobody takes them serious anymore today. But I think what they can teach us, or what we can see from this, is how important it is to have a proper method. You see, if I read the suttas and there is something that doesn't appeal to me, it is very easy for me to just say, well, this must be late, and there's some of these later monk generations, these reciters or even editors, they must have put it in. But that is a type of argument that I can make that argument for any kind of idea I have. And so actually what these kind of theories tell us is not so much what early Buddhism is about. They more tell us about what's going on in the head of those scholars who have these ideas, I think, about their limitations. And so what I feel, what for us is very important, is that we have a very clear-cut method. That is, we look at a discourse, and only when we find a difference between the parallel versions, then there is some room of saying, well, obviously one must be later, one must be earlier. And sometimes they just stand side by side and we are not even able to tell. But sometimes there are certain arguments we can make. We can look at how does it fit with the rest of the teachings. There's this, even tradition itself proposes these four great standards I mentioned last time. Does it fit with the rest? Does it introduce palpably new ideas or new vocabulary? And then we can make an educated guess, but even then often we cannot be sure. So I would just like us to well, this is actually what I'm trying to trying to transmit in a way to you. Let us have that historical critical perspective, but let us not get skeptic. Let us not just wave off everything as, ah, this is late, without having real properly looked at it and investigated it and found really sound arguments for that. I'm not saying anybody of you is doing that, n not at all. It is just that I thought it's a good time to, at this point in the series of lectures, to give a counterbalance to the emphasis on a critical approach that I'm presenting throughout. Yeah, that was the first methodological issue that I wanted to briefly mention. Yeah, last time we had Madhyama Agama 8. There we had these seven sons. The first son, the tree dried up, and then the next rivulets, and then the rivers, then the springs of the great rivers, the water of the ocean. All water dries up. The earth is in smoke, and finally the earth is in fire. And then we had this second part of the sutta, where we get the tale of somebody called Sunetta, who in the past taught a path to a heavenly rebirth. And this is contrasted to the Tathagata, who teaches the path to liberation. And we found that in the Madhyama Agama version is unique insofar as it makes Sunetta a past life of the Buddha. And so at the end of the last lecture, I had presented a series of examples that I think allow us to conclude that there's a pattern that stories which originally could have been mere parables or anecdotes or to illustrate something in the course of time are taken literal, They are thought to be something that really happened in the past, and that the one who tells them, the Buddha, does so because he recollects them as one of his former existences, being one of the three higher knowledges that he attained in the night of his awakening, the ability to recollect his former lives. And so there is now two issues that we would like to still discuss a little bit about this sutta. One is this whole idea of these seven sons and what is its significance. And the second, the connection between the first part to this sunnetta tale. So first here I have a comment by Manfred Wiesberger. So he said, "The Buddha surely knew that with that flimsy story you do not get anybody. We know a lot, starting from the very imminent danger of atomic power to the fact that resources are limited on this planet and that the sun will burn out someday. Who cares?" And I thought that was a very good point to make to and the way I know Manfred, he sometimes likes to put these things out to see how what people do with it, to get some discussion going, and he was very successful with that. There's a teaching on really practicing impermanence somewhere else in the discourses, which emphasizes to be aware of impermanence at a very short time distance. The next morsel to be eaten, the next breath to be taken, could not happen. And that is actually a recollection of death. I could die any moment. And so that is a very imminent way of bringing out impermanence. Whereas this image here of those seven sons, as Manfred rightly says, it's so far off, who cares? But then there were several replies to that. There's a very nice reply by Dania Percy to that. She said, "Would one cling so much to our laptops, achievements, art, books, if one were to know that one day everything will disappear and be burnt? All our possessions, our home, our history, and what we left behind will be gone. None will be alive to even remember us, and we would leave no footprint behind. If the whole earth is destroyed, there will be none to remember Chopin or Einstein, not even the Buddha. All will be gone." Yeah, I thought that was a very, very, very powerful statement she makes there. Brings out a dimension of this simile of the sun that makes it actually quite powerful. Then there was Michael Dove. He always gives this succinct kind of sayings. He just asks, "Are the seven suns like the jhanas and attainments progressively burning up desire and certainties about the five sense world?" I thought it was a very, very nice way of putting it. And then there is a somewhat more scientific perspective being brought in by Darshana Makavita. He says, "The seven suns' destruction of Earth seems to fit in with current astronomical theories about what will eventually happen to Earth. So it seems to me that the Buddha's description of the end of Earth is very accurate, because as the sun keeps becoming brighter, the temperature of the Earth will increase. And at a certain temperature, we will start losing the small streams, then in successive stages, the large rivers, the sources of the rivers, etc., until the whole earth is totally burning. The main difference is that according to science this will be from our sun going through its successive stages, but in the sutta it is from seven suns." And he asks, "Any possibility what the sutta mentioned are not seven separate suns but successive stages?" Yeah, I found that is actually the way also how I would interpret the simile. But before getting to that, I wanted to first of all remind us that we are in a hot climate in India, where the sun is not necessarily something experienced as we do that here in the West. Oh, wonderful, finally the sun is out and let me go out to bathe in the sun. But the sun is usually something that one avoids. One avoids exposition to the sun because it's burning. And as Darshana already suggested, I would interpret, we talked about the symbolism of the number seven, I would interpret the image of seven suns as meaning an increase in heat. It becomes so hot as if there were two suns, three suns, four suns. I wouldn't take it totally literal, because in that way it becomes more meaningful. I'm not necessarily saying that this is the only way to interpret it, but I think that makes it more meaningful. And ancient Indian cosmology believes that the earth goes, the whole universe goes through periods of contraction and subsequent expansion. So this idea seems to be a ancient pan-Indic idea. And the idea that it all contracts and the earth comes close to the sun and then gets burned up, it's not something specifically Buddhist. But as Darshana said, it would fit with the modern ideas of how the universe evolves. And another point I also thought is that if we think of somebody living in a small village in ancient India, no TV, no cinema, etc., then this depiction of a whole Holocaust that is going to destroy the earth, it would have led to a very rich imagination. Fire is something they would all know. So I think this might also have more of an impact than it might have to our modern eyes, who are used to see apocalypse of this and that type on the TV or on the internet or wherever. And then there's one more point. Both sutras actually have a report that the Buddha concludes by saying that only those who have seen the truth will understand or have faith in this. Those who have seen the truth are stream enterers, at least they are Aryans. So, as I said before, this idea of a wholesale destruction of the earth was apparently a pan-Indic idea. I would therefore not understand this statement to mean that only stream enterers, etc., only noble beings will believe that such a thing happens in future, but I would rather interpret it as meaning that they will take that serious. They will take this idea of a wholesale destruction in the future serious enough to apply that to their present situation and not do what Manfred has so rightly pointed out is so common in our modern world, to just brush things off as long as they do not immediately concern me and my short lifetime. There's a beautiful little tale in another discourse in the Madhyama Agama and Majjhima Nikaya on a king called Makadeva, and this king is opulent king, and he tells his barber, look, when you see the first gray hair on my head, let me know. So one day the barber finds the first gray hair and he tells, and on that notice that King Makadeva then gives up his throne, asks the crown prince to take over, and retires to live the life of a hermit and practice the same kind of meditation that our sonetta also practiced, the Brahma Viharas. And there is another of these tales who very beautifully, I think, show that some people react on the first notice of old age or impermanence or death or whatever it may be immediately. Whereas, I mean, you can't see it, but I have quite a lot of gray hair already, and here I am. Yeah. That was on the Seven Suns. I briefly stopped to see if there's any further comment or question on the Seven Suns before I get into the second part, the Sonata and Tathagata. Yeah, so I continue. On the Sonata tale, there was a comment by Wanru. She says, I see the metaphors on the seven suns, impermanence and dukkha, somehow manage to link to the different level of practice between Sonata and Tathagata. Sonata only managed to achieve a heavenly rebirth, which is impermanent and still bound to dukkha. Yeah, I also felt that there are, if we look closer, we find some inner connection between this teaching on impermanence and Sunetta. It's actually, yeah, let me first give another comment before I come out with this. This is by Sergio Guillermo Canova. He says, regarding the seven suns, the last two paragraphs of the Anguttara Nikaya parallel speak of the four conditions that Sunetta did not develop: right conduct, concentration, wisdom, and full release. So the only way to escape the destruction of the world is through full release. Yeah. The Madhyama-Agama parallel says something similar in different wording. It doesn't speak of right conduct, concentration, wisdom, and full release, but it has this here. The teaching I gave at that time did not lead to the ultimate, was not the ultimate purity, not the ultimate holy life, not the ultimate completion of the holy life. So there's a difference in wording, but the meaning is the same insofar as it clearly points out that this teaching that Sonetta gave was not the final path to liberation. Now, according to the Pali commentary, the Pali commentary points out that by developing the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness in particular, and the others are compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, one will be reborn in the Brahma world. And according to the cosmological ideas, the Brahma world will not be burned up in this conflagration that we get described with the seven suns. So Sunetta managed to get out of trouble, if we could put it like that. He had found a way of escaping from the conflagration once. But as Wanru and Sergio point out, it's not the full solution yet. It's only a temporary refuge, maybe. So the only final solution, and that is the point with which the discourse concludes, is to follow the path to liberation. And so the point of the whole discourse then, it is that those who listen to it, they get the unique chance of having a Tathagata sitting right in front of them, who teaches them the path to liberation. So they should make an effort now, as long as they have this opportunity. Make the best out of this extremely fortunate opportunity. Then there is one more comment. This is the last. Yeah, it's the last of the comments I like to share with you. This is by Laura De Bernardi. She says, in the Seven Sun Discourse, I wonder whether the link between the teaching on impermanence and the example of Sonetta makes sense in the light of disenchantment. To consider impermanence is to become disenchanted with the world, one's hopes, dreams, achievements, attachment to people, one's love of nature, all this diminishes. What's left? Nihilism? Cynicism? Sunetta decides upon loving kindness as something that can bring goodness to his life and others. And while that's important and is of wonderful benefit, it ultimately is lacking. Is it possible that the Buddha offers Sunetta's example as a way of indicating how important loving kindness is as a response to disenchantment, as well as its essential limitations? Yeah, I found this a very interesting point. And from a practical perspective, I can very much relate to that. Not sure now if this is really the what the discourse wants to tell us, but that's not so much my point now. But there is a thing on insight meditation, disenchantment, that can lead to negative is perhaps too strong, but can lead to some degree of withdrawal. Yeah, the right word doesn't come right now, but there's a kind of dryness in the heart. I think that is the word I'm looking for. Yeah, there's a kind of dryness in the heart that needs the counterbalance of samatha, of tranquility meditation, and in particular the Brahma Viharas are extremely helpful for that. So I find this from a practical perspective a very meaningful way of looking at this discourse. Yeah, these are the comments from the blog that I wanted to share with you. Now, is there any comment or question on this material? Good, then we go for the next. We clear the chat, get the other file. Yeah, now we are getting into purification. Yeah, I perhaps first need to a little bit explain again about the title I gave to the course, Purification, Ethics and Karma. The course is mainly meant to be a reading through the Madhyama Agama, and with Purification, Ethics and Karma, I was just pointing out topics that we will definitely cover. But as you have already noticed so far, we kind of move through quite a range of topics. But now we definitely have come to one of these, and with the next discourse we come to ethics, and with Madhyama Agama 11 to karma. So we are now touching on those central topics. And by way of introduction, I wanted to first overview the notion of purification in early Buddhism. So I have a few quotes here for you. The first is a stanza in the Dhammapada, and I'm abbreviating it. It just says, by oneself one is purified, one may not purify another. That is one of those central points made on the notion of purification in early Buddhism, that one has to make an effort oneself. The next I have is a passage from the Samyutta Nikaya. We have a similar passage also in the Chinese Samyukta Agama. And that is a statement made by the Buddha. He is being challenged by Mara that he has not really reached awakening or purified himself. So he states, by developing the path to awakening, morality, concentration and wisdom, I have attained supreme purity. The reason I chosen this quote is that it introduces us to the basic threefold training, morality, concentration and wisdom, as the main means for purification. The next quotation I have, well, just a reference, is the four purifications of a gift in the Dakinavibhanga Sutta. We discussed it already earlier. This principle that a gift can be purified on the side of the giver and on the side of the recipient. So we get four different types according to whether one or the other of these two is maintaining morality or not. Then there is purity and recital of the Patimokkha. The Patimokkha is the code of rules of monks and nuns. Every fortnight we come together and this code of rule is being recited. And each of us sitting, each of us monks or nuns sitting in the Sima, in the area where this takes place, expresses purity by silence. Whenever a rule comes up, we keep silent. That means we are pure in this respect. And if a monk or a nun has broken any of these, then these have to be disclosed. This means that early Buddhism sees confession of moral breaches as a form of purification. The study of this recital of the Patimokkha by several scholars has come to what I believe is pretty much a generally accepted conclusion that at an early point this disclosing of one's offenses was actually taking place during the actual recital. Nowadays what we do is that before this recital we pair off and confess to each other. And usually we do a kind of a summary confession so that we are pure and that the recital can go on without any problem. Then there is number five in my list. There is purity and teaching of the Dharma. I thought this is particularly relevant to me. Yeah, not only reciting the code of rules, but teaching of the Dharma can also take place in a way that is pure or impure. And impure is if I will be sitting here and thinking, ah, I hope they get so inspired in me, I hope they find I'm such a wonderful teacher. That would be teaching the Dharma in a way that is impure. Purity is when one teaches not to get personal acclaim, but rather with the wish, may this be of benefit for others, may they come to understand. One teaches out of compassion and empathy. Now with number six, we move on from the realm of what is in some way related to morality to the realm of concentration. Purification of the mind in particular means purifying the mind from the hindrances. This is a standard description in the discourses that after having established some degree of moral conduct, a monk or a nun retires into seclusion and purifies the mind from the hindrances. And it is when the mind is purified in this way that the absorptions, the four absorptions, can be attained. And these are by definition purified from the, these are five hindrances, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. These are impurities of the mind. Now the four absorptions are already stages of purity, temporary purity attained, and these enable the attainment of various supernormal abilities according to early Buddhist meditation theory. And with two of these, the notion of purification comes up again. I have this here under number 7. There we get the standard description that somebody purifies the eye or the ear, and this then leads to the supernormal ability of seeing or hearing things at very far distances. Then we have the notion of the direct path for the purification of beings. We are now at number 8. We are getting more also into the development of wisdom and insight now, but not entirely. This is particularly well known for the satipatthanas, the four establishings of mindfulness, is the way how I like to translate this term, as a direct path to the purification of beings. But we also get this for the four limbs of stream entry. These are firm confidence in the Buddha, the teaching and the community, and pure moral conduct. We also have such a statement for the four purities, which are mentioned only in one discourse, in the Anguttara Nikaya among the fours. This is purity of morality, is keeping the precepts. Purity of the mind is the four absorptions. Purity of view is insight into the four noble truths. And purity of liberation is the full awakening. And we also get this for the six recollections. That is a standard set of recollecting meditations. We find this in the Anguttara Nikaya under the sixes. That is recollection of the qualities of the Buddha, of the Dharma as his teaching, and of the community. Recollection of one's own morality. Recollection of one's own liberality, of one's giving. And recollection of devas. Not the point with the last one is not recollecting gods as such, but rather there are certain qualities that made these beings now live in a heavenly sphere, and I also have these qualities. And by developing these qualities, I also will be able to be reborn in a heavenly sphere. This is the recollection of devas. It's just interesting to see again that we get this broad scope that, yes, as we saw in the last tale with the sunetta, the main point is liberation, but there is always room also for those who aspire to other goals. Yeah, then quote number 9 I have, this is three stanzas in the Dhammapada. All conditioned things, these are sankharas, are impermanent or are dukkha or are not self, and when one sees that, this is the path to purity. This is the essential insight teaching as a way to purification. And my last quote is, by wisdom one is purified, and it is the purification through wisdom that is the highest and the most central in early Buddhist thought. So that was quite a lot of material now, and I would invite comments or questions on this before I get into the actual discourse. There's a comment by Manfred. He says, purity, especially ritual purity, was and is a major obsession with Brahmins. So the impact of this redefinition is hard for Westerners to comprehend fully. That is a very, very good point you're making. Yeah. For our understanding of the use of this terminology, we have to keep in mind the ancient Indian context. The concern with purity, as Manfred rightly says, especially the concern with ritual purity, the belief that one can gain purity through certain external actions, and that for the proper carrying out of rituals, purity is also important. Purity is a very central concern in ancient Indian thought. We can think of these Brahmins who, the idea that by ritual washing in certain rivers, one will get purified. And so there is this redefinition of the notion of purity that we get in these passages. Yeah, we will come a little bit. I have the topic of the ancient Indian context. I think I have that for next lecture when we get into karma. where I get into the different notions of karma. Is purification, ethics, karma, all this is pretty much interrelated. No, karma is not the next, ethics is the next, it's the in two lectures, yeah. But that is a very important point to keep in mind. Any other comments or suggestions? Well, then we go for our discourse. So we are in Madhyama Agama number 9, the discourse on seven chariots. And this is the parallel. Ah, there's a comment by Manfred. It also has an impact on the social structure. Could you kindly add something to that? Because I did not fully understand what you meant by impact on the social structure. Ah, and yeah, the caste system. He says Brahmins were pure and Sudras impure. Yeah, that's another point to keep in mind, that this whole the social structure in ancient India was very much guided by purity and pure people by birth avoid any kind of association as much as possible with those who are by birth destined to be impure. Yeah, it's a very large topic. Thank you, Manfred. So now we go into Madhyama Agama number 9. Thus have I heard. At one time the Buddha was staying at Rajgarh in the bamboo grove, together with a great assembly of monks who were spending the rains retreat there. At the same time, the Venerable Punnamantani Buddha was spending the rains retreat in the Buddha's native region. Yeah, Punnamantani Buddha, he is, according to the information we have from the Pali tradition, he was from a Brahmin family in Kapilavatu, the place from which the Buddha stemmed. And his second name, Mantani Putta, is taken from his mother. He is the son of Mantani. And she is said to be the sister of Anya Kondanya. This is one of the very first disciples of the Buddha. And we are told that after the first discourse given by the Buddha, the discourse setting in motion the wheel of Dharma, this Anya Kondanya, one of the very first disciples, he went to Kapilavatu, and he was the one who ordained Punna Mantani Putta, whom we are meeting in this discourse. And Punna stayed in Kapilavatu and practiced there, and also gave teachings and became an arahant himself, and also led several monks to become arahants. Punnamantani Putta does not occur very often in the discourses. He occurs one more time in the Samyutta Nikaya. Then there is a passage where Venerable Ananda, the Buddhist attendant, says that he became a Sotapanna, he became a stream entry, after hearing a teaching by Punna. And in the list of eminent disciples, Punna is said to be outstanding for teaching the Dharma. So this is one of the precious passages where we meet Punnamantani Putta, and I continue with the discourse now. Then a number of monks who had concluded the rains retreat in the Buddha's native region, the 3 months being over, having mended their robes, put on their robes, took their bowls, and left the Buddha's native region for Rajgarh. Traveling by stages, they reached Rajgarh, where they went to stay in the bamboo grove. Then those monks from the Buddha's native region approached the Buddha paid their respects by bowing down their heads and set to one side. And the Blessed One, that is the Buddha, asked them, "Among the monks living in my native region, which monk is praised by the other monks thus?" And then we get a list of qualities. The first is having few wishes and being contented himself. He speaks to others in praise of having few wishes and being contented. And this basic pattern we get in the first quality continues throughout. It always gives a quality that this monk has himself, and he also praises or encourages others to have the same quality. And the qualities we get here is having few wishes and contentment. Then the next is living in seclusion. Then being energetic. Having right mindfulness. Having mental one-pointedness. Having wisdom. Having destroyed the taints. And having himself exhorted, inspired, and fully delighted others. And here I give again the second part that goes with all qualities. The same also for others. He speaks in praise of exhorting, inspiring, and fully delighting others. And so the monks from the Buddha's native region reply, "Blessed One, among the monks living in the Buddha's Blessed One's native region, praise the Venerable Punnamantani Putta in this way." So Punna is outstanding for having these qualities himself and for teaching them to others. The Pali parallel list I have given here, it has a few wishes and contentment as corresponding to the first quality in the Madhyama Agama. Then it has being secluded and then not socializing, which we don't have in the Madhyama Agama version. It's being energetic is the third one in the Madhyama Agama. Then we have virtue. This is not explicitly mentioned in the Madhyama Agama. Then concentration, wisdom, liberation. This corresponds to the Chinese. Then knowledge and vision of liberation. This again is not found in the Madhyama Agama. And then teaches others. This corresponds more or less to the last quality. So we see again there are some slight differences. These are not really depicting a different monk, a different character, but they show difference in wording. I mean, even though not socializing is not mentioned in the Madhyama Agama, the fact that he lives in seclusion implies the same, and his attainments imply that he also must have been a virtuous monk. And what I like to just again highlight is this basic pattern. First, one establishes oneself in some quality, and second, one establishes others in the same quality. And this is something I find quite persistent in early Buddhist teachings. And it is important to note that, I feel, because it is sometimes overlooked. There is sometimes this idea that early Buddhism teaches only concern with oneself, striving hard to get the path, move forwards on the path to liberation. But if we closely read the early discourses, I feel that this concern with reaching full liberation is the central goal. It's always there. But there is there's always some breadth to take others along on that path, if I may say it so. And there's these two main points that I like to make. One is, without having something done oneself, how could one help others? or I should say without having something achieved oneself. That's a very, very, very crucial point, that unless one is established in something oneself, and this is what, according to these monks, this is the case with Punna, he gets some quality and then he encourages others. But then, as a second thought, having achieved something, how could one not wish to share it with others? It seems so natural to share it with others, to encourage others, to praise others who develop also this quality, because one sees the benefits for oneself. Yeah, at this point again, I like to stop and invite questions or comments before we continue with the discourse. So there's a question by Robert, a question according to of understanding whether number five, having mental one-pointedness, equal to having attained the absorptions. Yeah, it is. I think it is almost equal. One-pointedness, strictly speaking, can already be developed in a stage that borders on jhana attainment, but it comes to full bloom, to full blossom with the jhanas, with the absorptions. Yeah, very useful to have these understanding questions also, then we can clarify right away. So mental one-pointedness stands for the ability to collect, tranquilize, calm and settle the mind, that it becomes internally unified, and the experience of internal unification is particularly prominent with the absorptions. But the expression one-pointedness or unification of the mind can also refer to levels of concentration that border on jhana but have not yet reached full jhana attainment. So another understanding, what is meant by, Robert says, another understanding question, what is meant by energetic? Well, this is the quality of energy, virya in Pali. And that basically means that one has to do something about it when one has negative qualities. One needs to do something against it. And when one has positive qualities, one needs to do something to protect them and make sure that they grow. And this is one of the aspects of the Eightfold Noble Path under the heading of right effort, making an effort. Something that in the discourses is very much emphasized, the importance of making an effort. Yeah, there are more questions coming. Andrew says, I know this is probably an oversimplification, but it does seem to be stages and one is built over the previous. Yeah. That is definitely so. There is a sequence, a gradual building up that we can see in these qualities, from basic to more sophisticated qualities. We're having one builds on that, and while developing that, one develops also the next. Nice point, yeah. Andrew adds, can I say one is a condition for the next? Yeah, I think so. I mean, we could make a case that somebody can be energetic even though he or she does not yet have few wishes, and in the course of time will develop few wishes. But I think the basic pattern underlying these qualities is definitely what you have pinpointed. Yeah. Having right mindfulness might also be possible when one is not yet living in seclusion, but obviously seclusion would be useful for that. So we can make small. We could make some small counterpoints to stop us from taking this too rigidly. But the basic pattern is definitely so. Yeah, these build on each other. Having few wishes and being contented makes it easy to go into seclusion. In seclusion, I'm free from distraction. I can really practice energetically. Practicing energetically, then the right mindfulness develops. Based on mindfulness, the mind becomes calm and concentrated. The concentrated mind sees things as they really are, the development of wisdom. With the development of wisdom, I destroy the influxes or taints, the asavas. And one who has become an arahant, he or she is obviously ideal teacher to inspire others, to exhort others. Yeah, very good point. Yeah, the same also goes for the Pali listing. Yeah, so Venerable Sariputta has overheard what the praises spoken of Punnamantaniputta, and he thinks to himself that he would really like to meet this monk and have a conversation with him. I think Venerable Sariputta is probably not necessary for me to be very detailed in introducing him. He is the most outstanding disciple of the Buddha for wisdom, and he is said to have become a stream enterer even before meeting the Buddha, but meeting another Buddhist monk on the street and just being given a few verses, a stanza, and on hearing that stanza, he got insight. He became a stream enterer. He told his friend Maha Moggallana, and they together went to the Buddha to ordain. They are said to have been disciples of another teacher at that time. And Moggallana then becomes an arahant within 1 week, and Venerable Sariputta within 2 weeks. And Sariputta is sometimes called the general of the Dharma, or the one who turns the wheel of Dharma after the Buddha. And according to the Theravada tradition, he died several months before the Buddha. The third chapter in the Madhyamagama, into which we will be getting at some point during next year's series of lectures, is discourses entirely spoken by Sariputta. So at that time we will have an occasion to get to know him and his teaching style. There's a small thing I like to just notice on the names of these two. Venerable Sariputta's proper name is Upatissa. So Sariputta is the son of Sari, Punna is the son of Mantani. Both are what we call matronymics. Both take their name from their mother, not from their father. And I think that is significant. There is sometimes been the suggestion, I think, by I.B. Horner, that the preceding the obviously, a patriarchal society in ancient India at the time of the Buddha, there might have been a period earlier where women had a stronger position in society. We definitely find that from the time of the Buddha towards later times, the situation is getting worse. And one of those little hints at more eminent position held by women is this I believe this use of that the name of the mother is that one sees oneself as the son of Sari, of the mother Sari, or the son of the mother Mantani. But that is taking us away from the main subject of purification. So the Buddha has left for Sarvati, Sariputta also, and now Puna also comes to Sarvati. He has come from Kapilavatu to Sarvati. And here we continue with the discourse. Excuse me. The Venerable Puna Mantani Putta approached the Buddha and paid his respects by bowing down his head. Then he spread his sitting mat at some distance in front of the Buddha and sat down cross-legged. Then the Venerable Sariputta asked some other monks, "Venerable friends, is that the Venerable Puna Mantani Putta?" And the monks answered the Venerable Sariputta, "That is so. The Venerable One who is seated in front of the Tathagata, with a fair skin and a prominent nose resembling a parrot's beak, that is he." Then the Venerable Sariputta, having taken note of Punna Mantani Putta's facial appearance, retained a clear memory of it. Yeah, this little detail about Punna having a nose like a parrot is something we do not get in the Pali tradition. So then comes a description of how Puna, after having met the Buddha, leaves and goes into the town to beg food, and Sariputta does the same. And they take their meal, and the two versions differ if they spend the night now or not, but anyway, eventually they go to the blind man's grove, Andhavana. And here the discourse continues. In the late afternoon, after rising from sitting in meditation, the Venerable Sariputta approached the Venerable Punna Mantani Putta, exchanged friendly greetings, and sitting down to one side, asked the Venerable Punna Mantani Putta. Please keep in mind the two have not yet met so far. So Sariputta asked, "Is the Venerable One practicing the holy life under the recluse Gotama?" And Punna answers, "That is so." I would like you to notice that Sariputta here uses the term recluse Gotama. The Pali would be Samana Gotama. This is a way of referring to the Buddha which is not used by the Buddha's disciples in the discourses. In the discourses and in the Vinaya also, they will always speak of him as the Blessed One, the Bhagava. So the term recluse Gotama is used by those who do not consider themselves Buddhists. Other followers of other different religious groups in India, or lay people who are followers of these groups, they will address the Buddha as recluse Gotama. In the Pali version, this is not so. It is this, the expression recluse is only found in the Madhyama Agama. So I continue with the discourse. Sariputta asks, "How is it, Venerable Friend? Are you practicing the holy life under the recluse Gotama for the sake of purification of virtue?" And Punna says, "No." And Sariputta asks, "Are you practicing the holy life under the recluse Gotama for the sake of purification of mind?" And then he asks, "For the sake of purification of view, purification from the hindrance of doubt, purification by knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path, purification by knowledge and vision of the way, and purification by knowledge of the way to abandoning." So he lists his seven stages of purification, seven purifications, And in each case, he gets the reply by Punna that this is not so, that none of these is the reason why Punna practices the holy life, the brahmacharya under the Buddha. And here I have listed the Pali counterparts. So the first is purification of virtue, then a purification of mind, purification of view, purification by overcoming doubt. There's a slight difference in formulation because the Chinese version explicitly speaks of the hindrance of doubt. Hindrance would be the same as Nivarana, those which we mentioned before, the five hindrances that obstruct the attainment of deeper concentration. In the Pali version, it is just general doubt. In fact, the term used is Kanka, which is a little different from the term used normally for the five hindrances, which is a different Pali word, is Vichikicca. Then number five is knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path. This is the same. Knowledge and vision of the way. And the seventh in the Pali is just knowledge and vision, jnana and dasana. In the Chinese, it's knowledge of the way to abandoning. So we again get a slightly different terminology here. So Sariputta now asks, in that case, for the sake of what are you practicing the holy life under the recluse Gotama? And Punna replies, Venerable friend, for the sake of nirvana without remainder. And Sariputta asks again, how is it, friend, venerable friend? Is it for the sake of purification of virtue that the recluse Gotama designates nirvana without remainder? I'm aware that this translation reads a little awkward. That is, the Chinese original is like that, and we can't make it more palatable. But the point in the Pali version is the question is just: are you living the holy life for the sake of this purification, or is the question? To put it very simply, can purification of virtue be identified with nirvana? Is that the same as nirvana? That is the basic question that is being asked here. So he goes through all the purifications, that is of view, mind, view, the hindrance of doubt, knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path, knowledge and vision of the way, and knowledge of the way to abandoning. And Punna always remains saying no. So Sariputta expresses that he is puzzled, and then he gets an explanation from Punna. Punna says, Venerable friend, if the Blessed One, the recluse Gotama, were to designate nirvana without remainder for the sake of purification of virtue, then that would be to praise what is with a remainder of clinging, as being without a remainder of clinging. If the Blessed One, the recluse Gotama, were to designate nirvana without a remainder for the sake of purification of the mind, and he goes through all the rest. Then, he says, on the other hand, Venerable Friend, if the Blessed One were to designate nirvana without remainder apart from these things, then a worldling should also be able to attain nirvana without remainder, because a worldling is also apart from these things. Rather, Venerable Friend, it is through purification of virtue that one attains purification of mind. Through purification of mind, one attains purification of view, and through purification of view, purification from hindrance of doubt. Through purification from the hindrance of doubt, one attains purification by knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path. Through purification by knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path, one attains purification by knowledge and vision of the way. And through purification by knowledge and vision of the way, one attains purification by knowledge of the way to abandoning. And through purification by knowledge of the way of abandoning, the Blessed One, the recluse Gotama, designates nirvana without remainder. And at this point, Puna comes out with a simile, and this is the simile that has given the title to both discourses. He describes a relay of seven chariots. The idea is that King Pasenadi has to go from Savati to Saketa, a town not too far but quite some distance, and it is not possible to reach that town with a single relay, but what he does is he has these seven chariots stationed at different distances so that he can drive, and I assume he is driving his chariot very fast so that the horses will give him high speed but get quickly tired, and he drives the first part, then he changes over into another chariot, he gets fresh horses and he drives the next. And so by following these seven chariots, he is able to cover the distance to this other town in a very quick and efficient manner. And just as none of these chariots is the final goal, but each of these chariots is a means to lead to the next, and by that to lead to the final goal, the same is the issue with these seven purifications. None of them, at least in the discourse version, is the final goal, but each of them is required in order to reach the final goal. Then we come to the final part of the discourse. Puna asked the Venerable Sariputta, what is the Venerable One's name? How do his companions in the holy life call the Venerable One? This is preceded by Sariputta having asked the same question. And Venerable Sariputta replies, Venerable friend, my name is Upatissa and my mother's name is Sari. Therefore, my companions in the holy life call me Sariputta. Now the Venerable Punna Mantani Putta expresses his praise. He says, today, unwittingly, I have discussed with the disciple of the Blessed One. Unwittingly, I have discussed with the second most respected one. Unwittingly, I have discussed with the general of the Dharma. Unwittingly, I have discussed with the disciple who keeps the wheel of Dharma rolling. If I had known that this was the Venerable Sariputta, I would not have been able to answer with even one sentence, let alone discuss so deeply. Now, in the time that remains, I like to point out a feature of the discourse that, according to my understanding, throws a significant light on the seven stages of purification. These seven stages of purification are of eminent importance in the Theravada tradition as they form the scaffolding of the Visuddhimagga, but I believe this is a topic I will get into with the next lecture. In the discourses, we get this set of seven stages in the discourse we have just discussed, and we get them as part of a set of nine stages in a discourse in the Digha Nikaya, the Dasuttara Sutta. We just get the listing. This is actually this discourse, the Dasuttara Sutta, and also the one that precedes it is basically just listings of different items. And there these seven form part of a setting of nine. We get on top the purification by wisdom and the purification by liberation. And for an understanding of the significance of this purification from the perspective of the discourse is not so easy. Especially when we look at stages 3 to 7, what they actually mean. The normal sequence of the normal, the basic pattern of purification by wisdom, these stages after morality or virtue and mind cover the development of wisdom. Purification by wisdom normally in the discourses, the standard model is the four stages of awakening, stream entry, once return, non-return, and arahantship. Now, if we try to match these purifications with stream entry, we run into some trouble. Because according to Ratana Sutta, and they have this as a verse in the Pali collection, we have a counterpart in the Mahavastu of the Lokottaravada Mahasanghika tradition. It's fairly similar. At the time of the attainment of vision, that is of stream entry, three things become abandoned: the view of individuality and doubt, and whatever clinging to rules and observances there may be. The moment of stream entry is the moment of the first experience of nirvana. This cuts through these three fetters at that very point of time. The experience of the notion of self or individuality is gone for good, because the stream entry has had an experience that was without any self-referent. And doubt is also gone. And out of stream entry comes a very clear understanding of what is the path. So if we move up again and look at these purifications, we would say stream entry, with stream entry, view becomes purified, and doubt it is overcome, and knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path is attained, and knowledge and vision of the path is also attained, and even knowledge and vision to some extent is attained. So we have here things that in the scheme of excuse me, in the scheme of purification are building on each other, that follow each other like chariots in this chariot relay. From the perspective of stream entry, all these take place or find their culmination point at least together at the same moment. And this difficulty leads me to wondering if these seven stages of purification are really as central to early Buddhist teachings as they are in later Theravada tradition. And I would like to come back to what I draw your attention before, that Sariputta speaks of the recluse Gotama. I have here the question again: Venerable friend, are you practicing the holy life under the recluse Gotama? And this choice of word, the term recluse, is actually finds corroboration in a Sanskrit fragment that belongs to the same discourse. This is one of those wonderful opportunities to be grateful to all those Indologists who spend much time in piecing together these tiny little fragment pieces and deciphering them for us. We get here Vishuddhyartang Shramane also uses the word recluse. And my theory, my explanation is, since the term recluse is not the proper way how a disciple normally would address the Buddha, this is the more unusual reading, the Lectio Difficilior it is called, and therefore stands some chances of being original. It is much more easy to imagine that the reciters, because they know Sariputta is a chief disciple of the Buddha, even unconsciously make him say Bhagava, Blessed One, then that they change it the other way around. Now, if Sariputta uses the term recluse Gotama, what does that mean for the situation? It means he is pretending to, he is trying to not give away his identity. Pretending is perhaps too strong a word. Remember the situation, the two us have not met each other. Sariputta has heard this is Punna, and he's now going there and he's wanting to get Punna into a discussion. And in the Madhyama Agama, it's quite explicit. He says, look here, if I had known that this was the Venerable Sariputta, I would not have been able to answer with a single sentence, let alone discuss so deeply. So Sariputta has to not give away his identity. And he just walks in and behaves as if he were some other wanderer who just comes by and asks question about Buddhism. He says, "Are you living under the recluse Gotama? So what's the point of what is your practice about?" And I think at that this discourse probably takes place at a relatively early stage. And we find that in the Vinaya, the specific way of making robes for Buddhist monks was only decided at a probably later point. So it is possible that in the early generations of monks, they were just wearing the kind of robes that were not necessarily distinctive Buddhist robes. So that also visually, Sariputta is not necessarily recognizable as a disciple of the Buddha. If all these points I'm making are correct, then what this tells us about the seven stages of purification is that these were not necessarily a Buddhist scheme, but maybe ideas of purification generally held in ancient India. If they had been a very specific Buddhist teaching, we would first of all expect that they fit in much better with other teachings in the early discourses, and that we get also more information on them, not just being mentioned twice. And for them to be not specific Buddhist teachings would also make sense with this role that Sariputta assumes, that he walks in looking like, probably, and even behaving a little bit like some non-specific wanderer who meets a follower of the Buddha and likes to find out what the Buddha teaches. Yeah, that is my theory on the seven stages of purification, that the actual listing of purification may come from some ancient Indian background. And what in the Ratavinita Sutta is specifically Buddhist about them is then the way how Punna deals with them. That is, he points out that none of these is the final goal, but each of them is required to reach the final goal, and they build on each other. But the real final goal is nirvana without clinging. Yeah, I think that is what I had to say, and we are almost at the end, and last time I overdid, so I anyway owe you 5 minutes. So I think maybe at this point I return those 5 minutes to you, and we can have the discussion on my suggestion regarding the seven stages of purification or any other aspect that I have touched on in today's lecture on the blog, and then next week at the next lecture. So thank you very much for your attention. I hope that even though this is a little dry topic sometimes with all these purification terminologies, that this has been of some interest to you, and I wish you well and see you next week. Thank you.